Welcome to this podcast called Curious About Recovery. I am Kirsten Honeyball. I am your host. And in this podcast, I'll be diving deep into eating disorders, which are complex and challenging to navigate. So whether you're a sufferer, a professional, a family or loved one of a sufferer, you can join me as I get curious by interviewing professionals, chatting to eating disorder survivors, and sharing my personal experience with an eating disorder so that you can better understand various perspectives, remove stigma, hear inspiring testimonies, and simply get curious about all things eating disorder related. I would like to put out a trigger warning. These episodes explore the topic of eating disorders, and some content may be triggering to listeners. Topics explored may mention, but are not limited to, trauma, diets, food and body types, suicide, mental illness, substance use, self-harm, violence, gender identification topics, and more. Please take care before listening to any episodes. It's important to note that this podcast is not aimed to diagnose, treat, or cure any form of mental illness and should not be seen as a replacement for treatment of eating disorders. Everything said here is expressed in relation to personal and professional opinions, and listeners should be encouraged to view these episodes as an open-minded exploration of various possibilities and perspective rather than hard facts and solutions. Please take what applies or resonates with you and leave the rest. And if you're struggling with an eating disorder, don't hesitate to reach out to me at kirsten@kirstenhoneyball.co.za. Today on the show, we have Carrie Anderson. Having personally struggled with binge eating and weight stigma, Carrie's professional career is driven by a personal passion. In her 30 years of working with eating disorders, Carrie's recent work has been focused on binge eating disorder. Her unique ability to create a safe, non-judgmental, and healing environment make her, as patients often state, someone who gets it. Prior to private practice with MyEatingDoctor.com, Carrie positioned herself as a respected clinician and leader in the treatment industry. Having worked for eating disorder centers such as Green Mountain at Fox Run, Bermuda Ranch, and the Rader Institute, she had the opportunity to help thousands of patients and their families. Carrie earned her Doctor of Behavioral Health with her research project, The Mindful Eating Cycle, Treatment for Binge Eating Disorder at Arizona State University in 2012. She is the co-creator of Am I Hungry? Mindful for Binge Eating Program. Carrie also co-authored the acclaimed book, Eat What You Love, Love What You Eat for Binge Eating, a mindful eating program for healing your relationship with food and your body. Her newest book, Food, Body, and Love, was released last summer. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Carrie. It's wonderful to have you here. We have given you a little bit of a background introduction, but I'd love to know about the work that you do and a bit more about your personal experience if you'd like to share.
Sure. I'd love to speak with you today about my passion is binge eating disorder. My history is that when I was 8 years old, I started using sugar as a way to mitigate my anxiety and created a fantastic neural pathway for sugar in my brain. And as I got older and became more body conscious as a teen, it turned into a full-blown binge eating disorder. I went on to get treatment about 15 years later, and I have been a certified eating disorder specialist and treating eating disorders for over 30 years now. And what I've realized is that even though, you know, in 2013, we did recognize binge eating disorder as a standalone eating disorder in the statistical manual, I do find that treatments for binge eating disorder are largely ineffective. And I see people still struggling even after treatment. So that's why I've really focused on this in the last decade.
You say that treatment for binge eating disorder is often ineffective. And I know that, I mean, the most people I've spoken to on this podcast so far have been people who've helped with anorexia and bulimia and eating disorders such as that. And I think it's amazing to speak to someone who has a lot of experience in binge eating disorder because it's one of the most prominent eating disorders out there. And so when you say that the treatment is ineffective. I would love to know what makes this so. What are your thoughts around this and where are the gaps?
Well, I believe that in all of the eating disorders that we are starting to recognize the science behind the disorder, that it's not just a psychosocial cultural issue. And so in terms of the neuroscience and the biology and whatnot, and that's why I wrote my second book that came out last summer, is it really goes into some of the scientific things about our bodies and our brain that we need to understand in order to treat the disorders, all eating disorders, but also with binge eating disorder. And for so many years, and I was even, you know, part of this in terms of treatment, we would say it's not about the food. And I think that it is not about the food, and it is about the food. Mm-hmm. And we have to really look at it from more of an integrative, a mind-body approach, because there's things going on with the body that cause us to have intense cravings. And it's not just emotional. We used to label this emotional eating. And yes, we absolutely have emotional eating. If you look at the start of my eating disorder, I turned to food as a state regulator. I used sugar in order to calm me down. Basically, what I know today is that I was creating a huge sugar high, and then with the insulin coming in, and then a crash, and that crash put me in more of a kind of a trance-like state of low blood sugar, and that was what I interpreted as calming myself down. But now I understand the science and the metabolic implications of what sugar does to somebody when we eat it in such large amounts. So although I would not consider myself a food addiction model promoter, I have a great respect for what highly palatable foods, those foods that we have as humans manufactured that have salt, sugar, and fat. And those are all the yummy things that we create. Mm-hmm. And but I have a respect for it, because I know that those types of combinations of nutrients aren't really found in nature in terms of our whole foods. Those are foods that have been manufactured through, you know, baking and other types of things. And so my approach is what I consider a harm reduction approach. And so that I don't necessarily believe that all foods fit all the time. I believe that all foods fit, of course, because I don't promote an abstinence model, because that just backfires. But I do promote a harm reduction model, which means that we mostly eat whole foods and foods that promote good brain chemistry and thinking processes of clarity, that we eat foods that help promote a great gut microbiome through the fibrous whole foods that we can have, which in turn keep us calm. I mean, there's such a gut-brain axis through the vagus nerve that creates a lot of things in terms of our craving brain, whether or not we're anxious or we're calm. All the neurotransmitters are produced in our immune system, whatnot, are produced in our gut. And if our body is not healthy based on the things that we're eating, then our behaviors and our moods are not going to be stable. So I look at this from a scientific view, but I also look at it from a compassionate view. And what that means is that coming together with people, and so that they aren't so hard on themselves. They learn to befriend their body, befriend their nervous system, and join in collaboration with their body, and not to harshly judge. And that's where mindfulness does come in. My first book that I wrote, co-wrote with Dr. Michelle May, was on mindful eating for binge eating. And it's still a very prominent program, and people are healed from it a lot. But this book that I just wrote takes it kind of to the next level and says, okay, mindful eating and mindfulness is going to be the predominant intervention for this disorder, which is true for many. Like we talk about, you hear about DBT, ACT therapies, mindfulness-based stress reduction. All of these are mindfulness-based therapies, and they are effective with binge eating disorder. And at the same time, there are times that we cannot be mindful, and we're not mindful because we are in our automated, subconscious, habitual, behavioral situations. And so what I do is bring out is that when you say, I'm not going to do this anymore, and then you end up by the afternoon or evening, you're doing exactly what you told yourself that you weren't going to do, it's not necessarily your fault. It's let's take a look at this and say, what's going on? Because you wake up in the morning, and I always ask, they go, hey, doc, I'm not motivated. What's wrong with me? I tell myself I'm going to do something and then I end up not doing it. And I said, well, when you wake up in the morning, when you're rested, hopefully you're rested. And then there's other issues that we have to deal with in terms of people that have sleep disorders and aren't rested. But let's say you're rested in the morning. And I said, what's your resolve in the morning? I feel great. I know I have a plan. I know what how I'm going to treat myself with self-care and feed myself. And then everything unravels and falls apart by the end of the day. And I find myself binging in front of the TV. And then I just start up, I go to sleep and then I start again in the morning. And I have people look at that more from a scientific view of what's happening in their brains. Is that, their circuits are overloaded. Some people have more difficulty with feeling overwhelmed and ability to think. And if you can't be mindful, you can't think and you can't make good choices. And so I try to use a compassionate approach and say, what can we do then to regulate your nervous system throughout the day so that you're not spent by the end of the day? Or what can we do to help you become, what types of foods can you eat and to balance your blood sugar so you're more present? And then if you can't be present, then that's okay. What kind of speed bumps or guardrails can we put into place for you to keep you safe from making automated habitual choices that are subconscious? In the evening, how can we reduce the triggers that you deal with and be able to be, from a behavioral standpoint, do less damaging pivots in terms of our behaviors? And so that's why it's a little bit different. I brought in the science, but also made sure that mindfulness and compassion is there.
There's an incredible well of knowledge within you that I'm in awe of. And I really respect the passion that you have for this topic. And I think it's such a tricky thing because a lot of the time we are either faced with the extremes of diet culture, or we are faced with the extremes of the people who are going like, well, let's reject diet culture. So let's also then reject everything that makes scientific sense, And to hear from a professional's perspective, the idea of bringing it back to the compassion as well as the scientific going-ons of the brain chemistry and all of that stuff, it feels to me is a much more balanced approach, mm-hmm. is the approach to be able to say, like, I mean, I'm not going to get into the particulars of this because I don't want to sway my opinion in any one direction or another, but to be able to say, if you're eating a certain way, that there are particular things that then get affected in your brain chemistry. And we cannot be ignoring that, which is not to say that we can't include those things in our life, just to recognize how the body responds to them. You know, you spoke into this idea of harm reduction, which is definitely a holistic and balanced approach to binge eating disorder. And I have heard many, many people speak to me about this idea that there's no ability to be addicted to a certain food, or there's no ability to have a craving of a certain food because you've had that food in the first place. And I kind of think, well, my lived experience tells very differently, and so does the science. So could you tell me what you think about, can you talk to me perhaps a little bit about the scientific element of this?
Yes. I say to people, everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. So we should be able to, there's no shame. I mean, I do believe that our diet culture is very shaming in terms of food, and it's just food. You know, I mean, you really look at it, people are scrutinizing all the time. And I don't think that sugar is the devil at all. But what I do know is I have a healthy enough respect for how my brain handles it. And so what I do with people is help them to, what do you mostly eat? And to make sure that what they mostly eat, it comes from this place of this intersect of flexibility, because I think flexibility is really important. If you get too rigid, then you're going to get into the eating disorder. At the same time, a flexibility with really strong self-care. And when I talk about self-care, I mean partnering with my body and listening to it and knowing what it thrives on. Eating in a manner where I'm present, I have clarity of thought, I have energy of body, I have few GI distress, and I pay attention to my body and what I feed it and what it thrives on. Instead of, I can just feed myself anything and hope that my, you know, I'm going to feel great. Now, the older you get, the more you start to notice these nuances. Younger people, they're not as attuned to, you know, like, you know, GERD and reflux or bowel issues and things like that. But our gut is very much in line with our nervous system and our emotional life. And so what is it that we can do to feel our best? So high self-care, enough flexibility, but not so much flexibility that I eat anything, anytime, anywhere, right? Because then things start in our bodies and our minds start to go, we're not as in much as in charge of ourselves. So really being compassionate toward the body and what it wants. So when I look at harm reduction, it's eating mostly those things that my body thrives on, and from an energy wise and how I feel and whatnot. And then sometimes, right, the mostly and sometimes, because there always has to be sometimes. I'm not a abstinence fan at all, because there's these little parts of us that are quite, have quite food insecurity. There's parts of us that are rebellious. There's all kinds of, when we say you can't have this, we respond, we like autonomy. We don't like even ourselves telling us we can't do something. And so I use a lot of internal family systems as well to try to manage these parts of ourselves that pop up when we start imposing some rules, and to calm them down and say, you can have this. But what I do say in the harm reduction part is, it is some foods we may not want to keep in our house when we're in a mindless kind of a stress state, because we might not be able to make good choices when our brain is, you know, overtired and scrambled. So, but I believe that people need to have these wonderful foods that that we have manufactured, that that it brings the richness and the connection and closeness. But I believe that these foods are foods that we need to eat with others, mindfully, joyfully, making memories. But my experience with these foods are hiding, secret, eating mindlessly in order to dissociate into this place where, all is well, right? That I have used food in order to regulate my nervous state and or to get to sleep or to, but not eating joyfully, mindfully, making memories. That's not how I use these highly palatable foods in binge eating disorder. And so I know from experience, and that's why I write from this new book that I have out, is a memoir. It's it is experience as someone that's treated eating disorders for 30 years. I have a doctorate in behavioral health and understand the body and the physiology and neurology. And based on that, I'm looking back and go, I know exactly what happened and what went wrong and why I had an eating disorder. And that's the memoir part. And all the people that I've treated over the last 30 years and using some of their stories and it's a very engaging book because it's a lot of storytelling, but at the same time, there's a whole section in the book that's just on the science of eating, feeding behavior and food.
I think it's so incredibly necessary for us to look at it holistically, like you are explaining at the moment, and to be able to recognize that there are certain emotional, physical, mental, and even like you mentioned in your book, you know, there's spiritual stuff as well. And I think it just makes me think of a recent experience that I had was with a person close to me who came to me and felt that she has a little treat that she has every night before she goes to bed, and she didn't want to have it around me because she felt that she felt that there was shame around having this treat. Mm. And I challenged that thought, and I said to her, you know, having this one little thing before you go to bed that brings you joy, and it's something that makes you happy, and it's something that you love. It's like the idea that we are thrown into this idea that just because it's made of a certain substance or whatever, that it has to be wrong or bad, and there's a lot of shame and guilt around it. And then to bring it away of going like, where's the space for the joy, the experience, and removing the idea of guilt and shame around our food and body practices. And as soon as we recognize that there's guilt and shame around it, we can have the say like, okay, that's a red flag. You know, maybe this is something I need to be challenging. But then also not to be saying, okay, well, I'm now going to have that for breakfast, lunch, and supper, and all my snacks, and I'm never going to nourish my body with any other form of food, and I'm going to get stuck in rigidity. That's also not okay, you know, for a holistic kind of approach to an eating disorder. And one of the things that's really coming out for me as you speak is this idea of this mindfulness. It's about this communication with the self, with the emotional self, with the body self, with all of that stuff, and the ability to learn how to effectively communicate with your body both ways. Like, what is it telling me? Mm-hmm. And then what am I telling it? Like, for instance, recently I was tired and I thought, and anxious, and I was like, okay, I should have a cup of coffee to solve that. And I immediately realized in that point that I had said to my body, you're trying to send me a signal of you need rest, and I'm saying no, I'm going to enforce more energy in you when you're not asking for it, you know. So this ability to communicate with your body is so important to recovering from binge eating disorder. Can you give me some thoughts, some tips, some ideas of a person struggling with binge eating disorder that might be able to integrate into their day-to-day activities to begin that path of recovery?
I teach people to create a map of their nervous system. Mm-hmm. I incorporate, and I'm not sure if you're aware of, but there is a theory called the polyvagal theory, and it's about how important the vagus nerve is in terms of our connection to others, our ability to regulate our emotional states, and our autonomic nervous system. Even though it is autonomic, we do and can influence it. And so there's many, there's a thread of this all throughout my new book. And I've been doing a lot with helping people to map the different states of their nervous system. And when they get into what we call a sympathetic or fight flight or state, that they realize that they can no longer think clearly, right? Because it shuts off that executive function of the cortex of the brain. And so when they know that they're in this nervous state, that they might not be making good decisions. And so they have learned these, what triggers them into this anxious state, and also what I call the glimmers or the twinkle lights that help them climb back up the ladder, if you will, up to this, what I believe, this God-given state of clarity and connection and calm, that we're safe. And then there's also another, in this polyvagal theory, there's also another state, which is a collapse state, like you've fallen off the ladder, and it's a frozen state, and it's a dissociated state, and it's a depressive state. And so that's how I conceptualize anxiety and sympathetic and depression and collapsed and hiding in the what we call the dorsal vagal state. And so I teach them what happens when you get into these states where you know that's where the eating disorder occurs, is when you're in these types of physical states. And how then do you keep, you know, pull yourself out of these and been able to help yourself move into a state where you have more clarity and can make good choices, that you're more in charge. So I teach them about mapping their own nervous system and give them tools. I'm working a lot with how we, and you might have heard of the term HRV or heart rate variance. And heart rate variance is, it's not, you know, heart rate is how many beats per minute that your heart beats, but it's not like a metronome. It's not always sequential. Sometimes it's confused and rapid, and sometimes it's less. And there's a lot of variance in terms of the rhythm of the heart. And what we call the vagal tone, and I know I'm kind of getting in the weeds here, but I'll try to be as clear as possible. But to have good vagal tone, it means that you can rebound pretty quickly when you get startled or upset and you go into kind of a more anxious state, that you can rebound back to this calm and safe place really quickly. And that means that you have good vagal tone. And so throughout my book, I have all kinds of activities and self-care activities that you can do to help tone and improve your vagal, your heart rate variance or your vagal tone, so that you can rebound into calmness and a good thinking space and a connected space quickly. And so one of the newest things that I'm doing is I've just been certified as a safe and sound protocol practitioner. And what that is we use sound therapy or music. It's this filtered music system that actually using the portal of the auditory. So it's like an auditory vagal nerve stimulator therapy. And so you listen to certain filtered musics that actually is a neural exercise that helps make your vagal tone and increase your heart rate variance by just using music therapy. And so anyway, there's just so many different things that we know now that can help people. And I think the message is it's complicated. If I had one thing to tell people that had binge eating disorder or any difficulties with food, is be compassionate, because it's so complicated. And it's not just you making difficult or bad choices, end quote. It means that there's a lot of mechanisms going on in your body that have caused and created you to use food or struggle with food as a state regulator. And you can learn through all types of therapies. And I mean, we're learning now that even acupuncture or reflexology or massage and touch, and as well as community and connection, creates a better vagal tone. And so there's things that you may not have even thought of. And it doesn't come down to that I don't have willpower or that I don't make good decisions. Mm. There's just so much more going on. And so my message is just don't give up, and there you can learn so much more about what you can do to help yourself. So just traditional therapies is what I was trying to say, that are not taking in some of the new science, where, you know, I know treatment programs that still they're, you know, challenging people with binge eating disorder to eat Cheetos. And I'm saying, I need maybe as an exposure activity, right, to help train the brain not to be so excited and light up so much when you eat Cheetos. But Cheetos in itself, if you eat Cheetos, doesn't mean that you're recovered from your eating disorder. Because, yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's some pretty old school stuff that's still going on in treatment today. And so I encourage people, if they do need higher levels of care, to seek out people that are using more neuroscience and some of these mind-body approaches, because there's more going on.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating what you speak into. I love the polyvagal theory, and it's actually quite funny, because before I even knew about any of this stuff from a neuroscientific point of view and from a central nervous system point of view, I used to encourage people to to hum when they were stressed. And I don't know why I told them to do that, but I was like, this just seems to work.
I hum in my sleep. And it drives my husband crazy, of course. But I did that. I adapted before I knew anything about it. I used to also rock myself. And we know that rocking, humming, things like that really calm the system down. And I just intuitively began to do those things as self-soothers. So it is fascinating. Now it's kind of full circle coming around, and there's science to back all this up.
Yeah. And I think it's so important that you use the word self-soothing. I mean, when you think about it, and I think about my personal experience with binge eating as well, is there was always a sense of needing to feel okay, needing to feel soothed, needing to feel rounded in some ways, and the ability to now recognize that I was in a state that felt that I was not safe, I was not okay, and I needed physical soothing. Food at the time seemed like the answer, and an excess of it, because I never realized, you know, I mean, obviously there's all this other brain science thing going on, and then, you know, like you said, it's complicated, but when I started to learn how to self-soothe through physical exercises, through connecting with the body, connecting mindfully, and all of those things, I started to recognize that this became a very, very helpful replacement to the chaotic binges that I used to go into. And, you know, it speaks into this idea of, you know, a lot of food and body issues stem from a space of overwhelm, like you said, stem from a space of either emotional, physical, whatever overwhelm. It could be from past trauma, it could be from something that's going on currently, from high levels of stress. And even to some extent, this idea of, you know, we are in a system that thrives on hustle culture. We're having more and more people start to recognize the necessity of slowing down and thinking intuitively and giving wholehearted attention to themselves and balancing their energy. And I know that you do this in the practice, that you work with other people. And so maybe you could talk to me about the importance of creating holistic balance within oneself as a tool to recovering from binge eating disorder.
Well, we do know that the physical state of the provider, the counselor, the coach, whoever's working with an individual, it's essential that I be regulated. Mm-hmm. Because if I come into a session and I'm stressed or in any kind of sympathetic process, I will not be able to co-regulate my client. So I have to constantly be working on practicing what I preach. Now, when I left the treatment center world because I was in management and administration, and although I love teaching others, supervising and whatnot, running a treatment center had me running anxious all the time, the pressures and whatnot. And so it was a choice that my husband and I made for me to step down and to start my own private practice. And so the model of my private practice is I only see clients 3 days a week. And people say, they go, wow, you don't work very much. And I said, well, I do. I mean, I see between 15 and 20 people, like a really busy week. I might get up to 20, but for the most part, I see around 15 people. And for me, that creates balance for me. Now, I still come into work because on the other days, in fact, I often work Saturdays as well, but I'm doing what I'm passionate about and I love. I'm researching, I'm writing, I'm a blogger. I'm always creating new programs. Like I just got certified in this new safe and sound protocol. I have a online course that goes through my new book that I've got online. So I'm always creating. I have to do that because that's just my personality and pushing myself to learn more and to create more opportunities for people, especially more opportunities for people that are remote, that can't come into my office or programs that are affordable that they can get me, but not have to pay my hourly rate. And that's why I have some online coursework that people can do. So, but I only see my clients 3 days a week. And so that's my boundary. And so that's how I do balance. I also love to, I'm a cyclist and I'm in love with my Peloton bike. I don't know. I go into a whole nother space. This bilateral work on a bicycle can become really mindless. And that's where my creativity and my thinking come out. A lot of ideas for my book or blogging come from bicycling. So I do that. I have a fun little dog that I spend a lot of time with. She's a certified therapy dog. And she comes with me once in a while. She's getting old. It's hard to see her do that. And then my husband and I are thinking about, my mother was really the inspiration for this. She's 83 and she plays pickleball several days a week. And so it's becoming bigger here in the US, the pickleball scene. And so I used to play tennis and my knees kind of wore out. So we're looking at pickleball. So I think having these physical activities and calming activities and things like that are really important as well.
As you're speaking here, I just have this big smile on my face because I feel the joy that you allow yourself to experience in your life. And I think that that's definitely speaks into the rewards that come from the, at first, very challenging steps that you need to take towards your recovery when you are a binge eater. And then to be able to recognize that at the end of in the bigger picture, you're going to have this life that you can create for yourself, where you can do things that feel fulfilling, where you can have relationships, where you can help other people, and where you can just have things for yourself as well, and move away from expectations and rules and should and this and that, and into a space where you go, I am empowered. I have the ability to navigate my life. I have the ability to feel things fully, and I have the ability to do that without turning to food as the coping mechanism.
Yeah. You really do. You have to create a life outside of your food, because I talk about in my book about how there's a true attachment to food as a relationship. And there's scientific facts to show that the same neural pathways that we use for communicating and connecting with others, the social engagement system, is used as part of eating and ingestion. And so it's very easy to shift from relationships with others to a relationship with food, because it uses the same neural pathways. And so part of the healing process is to recognize that and to gently and compassionately start to let go of food as the primary relationship, and to take risks and start to connect with others and create a big life. Because people with binge eating disorder have very small lives. I know I had a very small life, where all you know, you're thinking about where you're going to get the food, you know, when you're going to eat the food, how you're going to hide the evidence, and, you know, and start all over, and then hiding your body because you don't want anybody to see it. It's very isolating. And so, and then what that does is it perpetuates the same attachment, because it's only safe attachment. So part of healing is about creating a much bigger life for yourself, and to take risks and start connecting with others through activities and interest and things outside of, and having to expose your body and become more neutral toward it rather than hating it or loving it, but neutral and seeing it as a vehicle for your life.
I love it. And it speaks then obviously into this idea of, you know, if we've got this relationship dynamic to food as the same that we would for people, then it makes sense. And we're working with the polyvagal theory, working on the social engagement state. It would help if we find that balance, then we're actually finding balance in our relationships and then our relationship with food as well. And there's even people who have said personify the eating disorder to make it like a person you're trying to move away from a toxic relationship. Makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned your dog, which I have seen on your website. Very cute. On your website, you've said you do faith-based and animal-based therapy. I think these are two incredibly fascinating modalities, and I'd love to know about these and how they benefit eating disorder therapy processes in general.
Well, we do know, and there's some fascinating research. If you were to go onto YouTube and look up Hearts Aligned, Purina put this video out. It's been out for several years. It shows about how dogs or animals can actually regulate and calm our heart rate variance. and that animals actually, their heart rate variance aligns with ours. It's a love connection. And at that point, and mammals work just as well as people, but you know, for many people, the dog or the pet therapy is going to be the safest situation. And so I use her to help regulate my patients and my clients. And so she'll, by her presence, they'll calm down. And if they're not calm, by the way, if we can't co-regulate and get our clients into a what we call the ventral vagal or a calm connected state, they're not going to benefit from any of the therapy that I do, because they're going to be in fight flight and they're not able to learn or take in and process. So a lot of people that are in a sympathetic fight flight in people's therapy, it's very expensive that they're getting all this therapy, but that's not it's not going to benefit them. So that's why I oftentimes will use my dog to help with that. And then in terms of my faith, in my book, Food, Body, and Love, love is really a compassionate state. And I believe that in my faith in God is that God is love, and that he created us to be connected and to be loved and to love others. And that's what it's all about. I can sum up my entire religious beliefs with that, is that the world was created, and people and animal, everybody was created with love in mind. And so if we can migrate toward that state, which is the ventral vagal state of the body and our regulatory process, then that we'll be less sick, we'll have more joy. And that's the way it was meant to be. Love for self is really based in that compassionate view of ourselves.
I love what you say there. I once heard a colleague of mine say that the only real battle we face when we're in an eating disorder is the one between perfectionism and grace. And it hit me right in the heart. It was just, and I carry that with me, because I'm always like, grace for me, whether you look at it from a spiritual perspective or not, is the unwavering faith that everything will be okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you can embody that, then you're well on your way to a beautiful and fulfilled life without an eating disorder, which I think is wonderful. And I love the fact that you use your dog. I definitely have felt personally calmer when I'm around animals, so I can understand how this is definitely an effective modality. So, you know, I'd love to know, just, I mean, we've spoken a lot about the books you've written, the qualifications you've got, but what would you say has been your personal highlight in this career of helping people with eating disorders?
I know that I'm in the right place, because I look forward to going to work, and I don't get burnt out. And I think it's based on how I practice, right? My boundaries in terms of how I practice. But when you look across from somebody and they have this relief that comes across their countenance and their, you know, the way that they present themselves, and that grace, like you know, the term grace, but they realize that they don't have to fight any longer, that it doesn't have to be so hard. And then they build up from that into this great self-confidence and self-directedness, and this feeling that I really am in charge of my life, and that I don't have to be and fall victim to this disorder, and that I may have needed this disorder and it might have been protective in nature for me. And I preach that as well, meaning that I don't believe that the eating disorder is the enemy. It was only protective until you don't need it anymore. That when they feel safe enough to be able to let it go. And it really is just this transition that I can see in body and mind from a fear state to a love state. I believe that when we're in a fear state, that's where the eating disorder grows and breeds and lives. It lives in fear. And when we can let go of fear and know that all is well, and that we can, both in body, mind, and spirit, live in the spirit of love, of a connection that is safe. It's a safe place for us. And so watching that transition, it's so fulfilling to me. And that's why I'm here, because I don't want people to have to live in fear anymore.
So beautiful. I love the fact that, you know, asking about what your personal highlight has been, and the first thing that you gravitate towards is, well, I light up from when I see others light up, you know, and that's exactly why you probably do the work you do, is because you have the ability to help someone navigate this very difficult and complicated process. And then realize that there's freedom and there's beauty and there's joy and there's peace and there's all of that at the end of the tunnel, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's incredibly inspiring. So thank you for those words. Before we wrap up for today's episode, is there any other things that you would like to touch on? Any words of encouragement or any message that you might have to share?
Well, I just want to say that there is help out there, right? You don't need to feel alone. Myself and all the people that work in this field, and thank you. Those of you listening that are working in this field. And I also want to say that, you know, it doesn't have to always be really expensive either. I mean, now that we have the internet, there are online choices that are available. I want to leave with you, for listening to this podcast, a coupon code that you can get from listening to this to give a $50 off of my online course that goes through all the science that I've talked about and the compassion. If someone wants to do that, and you know, you can, with the coupon, you know, that course online available to anybody is only $150. So it doesn't have to be expensive either, right? So there are opportunities. So I just want to say that it's not out of reach, or just purchasing a book and doing a self-study.
That's beautiful. So thank you for that. And I'm sure my listeners are going to jump on that opportunity. And it's wonderful. Where can we find you? How can we get in touch?
My website is very simple, myeatingdoctor.com, and doctor is spelled out. So myeatingdoctor.com, myeatingdoctor.com. Mm. And I'll make sure that you can have access to that coupon code, but it is Honeyball50.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. And Honeyball is my surname, is for those of you who have listened or haven't, it's HUNNEYBALL50, which is wonderful. Yay. Yeah. Thank you for that.
And so you can, I'll give you the link to the online course, but you can also find the online course on my website as well at myeatingdoctor.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And do you have any social media platforms that we can find you on?
Yeah. If you go to my website, they're all there.
Okay.
You can see all my social platforms. I have a Facebook group that people follow me. It's the Facebook group is Food, Body, and Love. And I'm also, I post research, do some live events, just little things that I enjoy that I pass on to those that are in that group. And you can find that on my website as well.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Definitely be sharing that with my listeners. And I really appreciate your time here today. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. As you can tell, I love talking about this.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. If you have liked it, share it with people who you think might benefit from listening to it as well. Don't forget to go to my Instagram page called @CuriousAboutRecovery to find out about upcoming episodes or to browse the episodes of the past. You can also follow my page called @KirstenHoneyball, where you can get inspiration for your eating disorder recovery.